All right, picture this. It's 2013, the world's going digital, downloads are everywhere, and physical media is basically on life support.
Right, everyone's switching to digital.
Yeah. But in this world of apps and instant updates, someone wants to bring back cartridges.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you heard that right. We're talking about a brand new console in the 2010s, hungry for those chunky plastic cartridges like it's, I don't know, 1985 again.
It really does make you scratch your head a little, doesn't it? Like, you've got this big push for sleekness, everything's digital, everything's instant, and then someone wants to rewind the clock back to cartridges.
Totally. And the mastermind behind this whole thing, Mike Kennedy. You might know him as the guy behind the Retro Gaming Roundup podcast, Retro Magazine,
Oh, yeah, I know Mike. Yeah.
and GameGabble, which was an online auction site for, you guessed it, retro games.
Yeah.
So the passion was obviously there, but could a brand new cartridge-based console actually work in the 2010s? This was the era of the PlayStation 3 and the Xbox 360. We're not talking about some niche idea here.
No, he was trying to jump into a boxing ring with some heavyweights.
Exactly.
And you've got to remember, for a lot of gamers at that point, cartridges were ancient history. They probably had one in their attic somewhere, but that was about it.
Yeah. I mean, they meant limited storage space, they meant higher costs, and let's be honest, the tech just felt outdated.
Right. Like, why even bother?
Exactly. So why would anyone even consider it? Well, we dug into Mike James's book, Smoke and Mirrors, The Rise and Fall of a Serial Antipreneur, and it turns out that even back then, some people saw, well, maybe charm is the right word,
Yeah.
in a new cartridge-based system.
You know, nostalgia is like a powerful thing. For a lot of gamers, those cartridges bring back memories. Blowing into dusty game packs, hearing that satisfying click when you slotted them in, there's a certain tangibility to it.
It's like holding a piece of gaming history in your hands.
Exactly.
And let's not forget about collectors. Limited run cartridges, special editions. It taps into that desire for something unique. I mean, you see a glow-in-the-dark limited edition cartridge,
Oh, I'm there.
right? Suddenly you're 10 years old again.
It's brilliant. But then reality sets in, doesn't it? Because as romantic as that idea sounds,
Right.
the book does a good job of showing just how many roadblocks were in the way.
Oh, yeah.
You've got a market that's already saturated. You've got the cost of actually making cartridges in a world of mass-produced discs.
And the technology.
Don't even get me started on the technology. Building a console that can even hold a candle to the HD graphics and online gaming, that was expected. I mean, people had smartphones in their pockets that were more powerful than a Super Nintendo at that point.
Right. So the odds were stacked against this from day one. So what does Mike do? He goes to a forum for his Retro Gaming Roundup podcast, and he just throws this question out there. Is there a market for a brand new 8-bit console?
Talk about leading with your chin, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, most gamers in 2012, you mentioned smartphones, they weren't even considering it. Cartridges were something their parents played on.
Okay, but get this. The whole console idea wasn't even originally Mike's.
Really?
It was actually his business partner at the time, Steve Sawyer. He just kind of tossed it out there as a joke during a brainstorming
Oh,
session.
no.
I know. They were actually trying to turn retro into this whole cultural thing.
Okay, I can see that.
Yeah, like a dedicated Twitch channel streaming old game shows, a radio station that only played music from the 70s and 80s.
They'd listen to that.
Right. They even wanted to start a game publisher that focused on retro-style games.
Okay, so not a bad idea on paper, maybe.
Exactly. But then Steve threw out the idea of a dedicated console, and even he knew it was a long shot. He later said, "I might have to apologize to a couple people. I think this in some way might be my fault." He never thought that Mike would actually run with it. But Mike, being Mike,
Yeah.
he heard new console, and that was it.
It was off to the races.
And the next thing you know, he's calling up every big name in retro gaming he can find to build his dream team.
Yeah.
So Mike's got this console idea. Well, it wasn't even his idea to begin with. And now he's got this burning desire to assemble a team.
Okay, so who'd he go with?
Only some of the biggest names he could find in retro gaming. I'm talking about Steve Wojta, the guy behind Kid Chameleon and Sonic Spinball.
Whoa, wait a minute. That's Steve Wojta.
The one and only.
Wow, his career's like a who's who of tech giants. Apple, Atari, Sega.
He even designed a joystick interface for the Apple II. And get this, Steve Jobs himself gave it the green light.
That's a pretty good stamp of approval right there.
Yeah, you're not going to find that kind of experience just hanging out on a forum somewhere.
No kidding. So Void is on board. Who else?
Mike brings in Bob Pilaro, another Atari legend.
I know that name.
Yeah, he worked on Defender and Rampage. Those were absolute game changers back in the day, pushing the limits of what games could do.
Oh, absolutely. And Pilar wasn't just along for the ride. He was the guy behind the code, making that magic happen.
And let's not forget, porting arcade games to home consoles back then, that was no walk in the park. The technology was so different.
He had to work miracles with, like, what, a fraction of the processing power and memory we have today?
Exactly. This guy knew what he was doing.
Okay, so you've got Wojta for the creativity, Pilaro for the technical wizardry. Who else?
Okay, you ready for this? Phil Adam.
Okay, now that's a name I haven't heard in a while.
He was the former president of Spectrum Holobyte.
No way. The company that brought Tetris to the West.
That's the one.
I spent months of my life addicted to that game. Still am, to be honest.
Right. That game is everywhere. And Phil Adam had a huge part in turning it into this global phenomenon.
Okay, I'm starting to see the appeal of this team. This isn't just some ragtag bunch of nostalgic gamers. Mike's pulled together some serious talent here.
Oh, yeah. And I'm not even done yet. Hold on to your hat, because Mike manages to get Ed Fries on a call.
Ed Fries. As in the Ed Fries.
The one and only.
Yeah.
Former VP of game publishing at Microsoft.
The guy who helped launch the Xbox. He's in the Video Game Hall of Fame.
Yep. Mike managed to rope him into a call. I guess he wanted to add a little legitimacy to this whole thing.
Well, it certainly doesn't get much bigger than Ed Fries. But I have to imagine Fries was looking at this whole thing like, you're doing what?
Pretty much. The book makes it clear that Fries saw both sides of the coin. He recognized the passion, the raw talent.
Oh, yeah. That team's a force to be reckoned with.
But he also saw disaster looming on the horizon. I mean, he'd been there, done that.
And probably seen a million great ideas crash and burn because of, let's be honest, the people involved.
Exactly. So what does he do? He gives Mike this golden piece of advice. I'm talking about advice that could have saved them a world of hurt down the line.
Yeah.
Fries was adamant that they had to define their roles and ownership from the get-go.
Music to my ears. Get it in writing, make it crystal clear who's doing what, who owns what piece of the pie.
Exactly. Otherwise, you're just asking for trouble.
Oh, you're practically begging for it at that point.
And spoiler alert, that's exactly what happens. Now, Fries couldn't exactly stick around.
Yeah, he probably had a million other things on his plate.
Well, there was also the Ouya, which he was advising at the time.
Oh, right, right. That makes sense. Potential conflict of interest there.
Yeah. But even with Fries out of the picture, Mike's got this dream team of retro gaming legends raring to go.
Yeah.
So you'd think, what could go wrong, right?
Famous last words, if I've ever heard them. This is where things start to go off the rails.
So we've got this team of rock star developers, right? These are the guys who brought us some of the biggest games of the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, legends.
But they're about to run headfirst into Mike's grand vision.
Uh-oh. This is where the Atari Jaguar comes in, isn't it?
You guessed it. Mike was determined to bring back the ghost of the Atari Jaguar. Remember that thing?
Oh, could I forget? The console that almost single-handedly took down Atari.
Ambitious.
That's one way to put it. So Mike had bought these Atari Jaguar molds.
Yeah, he bought the molds. Figured it would be a cheaper way to get the console off the ground. I mean, why design a whole new shell when you can dust off one from the graveyard of gaming history?
Okay, on the surface, I guess that kind of makes sense. But I'm sensing a but coming here.
Oh, a massive but. Designing a modern console in the 2010s around a shell that's two decades old. It's like trying to cram a Ferrari engine into a Model T.
Yeah, you might get it to work, but it's not going to be pretty, and it'll probably explode.
Which brings us to the whole emulated versus native games debate.
Yes. Because gamers love a good technical debate, right?
It gets a little complicated. Basically, Mike wanted it both ways. He wanted the console to play all those classic games through an emulator.
Makes sense. Instant access to a huge library of games.
Right. But he also wanted new games built from the ground up, specifically for the retro VGS.
Okay. So he wanted to blend the ease of emulation with the power of native development. Ambitious, to say the least.
So for those of us who haven't spent the last 20 years neck deep in console specs, what's the difference between an emulated game and a, what was it, native game?
Okay, so imagine an emulator as basically creating a virtual version of, say, a Super Nintendo inside this new console.
So you're basically tricking the old game into thinking it's running on its original hardware.
Exactly. It's like those apps you can get on your phone that let you play old arcade game.
Okay, that makes sense. So what's the downside?
Well, you're limited by that old hardware. You're not going to get those cutting-edge graphics and complex gameplay that you'd expect from a modern game.
Right, so then there's native development.
Native development is like building a custom house. You're starting from scratch, designing everything specifically for the hardware it's going to run on.
So you can really push the boundaries with graphics and gameplay and all of that.
Exactly. But, and it's a big but.
I bet it's expensive.
It's incredibly time-consuming and expensive. And you need developers who are not just familiar with the old-school stuff, but who can also create for this new hardware.
Okay, so Mike, with his Atari Jaguar shell and his grand vision, wants to do both.
He did. He wanted the best of both worlds without fully grasping the complexities of either. And this is where his lack of technical know-how really shows.
Oh, how so?
The book actually quotes him as saying he wants to run Unity close to the metal.
Close to the metal. I'm not a programmer or anything, but that sounds strange.
It is. Close to the metal means you're writing code that interacts directly with the hardware. It's about squeezing every ounce of performance out of the system.
Okay.
But Unity... Unity's a game engine known for being user-friendly. It's designed to work across different platforms to make development easier.
So he basically wants to build a race car that runs on wishes and hopes.
Pretty much. And he doesn't see why this is a problem.
So you've got these clashing visions, these technical roadblocks, and Mike's, let's call it, unique approach to technology. What happens next? Because I'm guessing this train's about to derail.
Oh, this is where the wheels really come off. Remember Ed Fries, the Xbox guy?
Yeah, the voice of reason in all of this.
Right. Well, Mike promptly ignored his advice about clearly defining roles and ownership.
Ah, here we go.
Things start going sideways. The project is sputtering. And what does Mike do? He starts pushing people out.
You mean like firing them?
Not exactly. More like just ghosting them.
Seriously?
He starts with Scott and UK Mike.
Wait. His co-hosts on the Retro Gaming Roundup podcast, his friends.
The very same.
Yeah.
Just stops returning their calls, avoids talking about the project. They were there from the beginning, brainstorming those early ideas, and he just cuts them off.
Wow. That's gold.
It's a classic example of someone getting blinded by their own ambition, you know? They forget about the people who helped them get there. And it really highlights why Ed Fries' advice was so important. Without clear roles, without written agreements... you're creating a recipe for disaster.
Right, because then it's not just a passion project gone wrong. It's potentially harming other people's careers, their reputations.
And this is where things take an even shadier turn. Enter Sean Robinson, Mike's new hardware guy.
Ah, Sean Robinson. The name is infamous in the retro gaming world.
To put it mildly.
So what's the deal with this guy?
The book only gives us a glimpse into Sean's past, but it's enough to make you run for the hills.
Oh.
Legal troubles, community warnings, a reputation for promising the moon and delivering, well, nothing. He's the kind of guy who could charm your pants off 1 minute and then disappear with your life savings the next.
Okay, so not exactly someone you want handling the technical side of your revolutionary new console.
Mm-hmm.
So how on earth did Mike find this guy?
Well, that, my friend, is a story for another deep dive. But I can tell you this. It involves broken promises, vaporware, and a whole lot of drama.
Man, what a wild ride. We started with this almost charming idea, a new cartridge-based console. A little slice of nostalgia in a digital world.
Sounds good on paper.
It really does. But as we dug deeper, as we often do in these deep dives, we uncover this cautionary tale about unchecked ambition, the importance of having the right people on your team, and the dangers of clinging to outdated ideas.
Because sometimes it's not the technology that fails, it's the people behind it.
And that's something to think about the next time you hear about some revolutionary new idea that's going to change the world. Ask yourself, who's driving this train?